This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we talk to a DNR specialist about how to avoid starting fires at the peak of wildfire season here in Wisconsin. Now, the Republican Party of Wisconsin held its annual convention this weekend ahead of the August primaries and November midterm elections. The candidates running to unseat Governor Tony Evers made their pitches to the delegation. One candidate emerged as the frontrunner, but none of them earned the required 60% support to receive a formal party endorsement in the race.
The second ballot in the governor's race having been tabulated, Rebecca Clayfish received 54.63%. Tim Rampton received 2.55%, and no endorsement, receiving 42%. There'll be no endorsement in the governor's race.
Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and U.S. Senator Ron Johnson also made headlines with their remarks and helped set the stage for the rest of the election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow coverage of the GOP convention this weekend, or were you there? What did you think about what we heard from state Republicans? Were you surprised, glad, unhappy that they didn't endorse a candidate for governor? And if you're a Republican, what do you want to hear from the party? If you are planning to vote for anyone in the November election, what are your hopes, your fears about what came out of the Republican Party convention this weekend and the race ahead? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. He covered this weekend's GOP convention in Middleton. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, I think obviously the biggest primary race for Republicans this year is the race for governor. How big a deal is it that there wasn't a formal party endorsement of one of their candidates?
I mean, it's a big deal to Rebecca Clayfish in that it's a setback to her campaign, I'd say. You know, if she had gotten that 60% threshold, she could have had not only the right to say, I'm endorsed by the Republican Party of Wisconsin, she could have unlocked the party's resources on her behalf. You know, the party could have done campaign work for her. And that could be significant in a race where she is facing, you know, a few challengers right now, including Tim Michaels, who is independently wealthy and has shown a willingness to spend that wealth on his campaign, and Kevin Nicholson, who's backed by Richard Uihlein, the GOP mega donor, who also backed Nicholson's U.S. Senate race in 2018. So, I mean, Clayfish is facing two people with deep pockets in this race. And any little bit helps. I think you probably still look at this race and say she's the front runner, but it's not like she locked it down.
And we don't have a lot of polling to go on here. The last Marquette Law School poll had Clayfish ahead of her competitors, but Tim Michaels wasn't in the race yet, and Don't Know was the leading candidate, I believe, in the responses there. But you know, 55% support from Republicans at this convention. She's selling that as a win.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a horrible outcome for her. There have been situations in contested primaries in the recent past where the leading candidate did have what you'd say was just an awful outcome. And I'm thinking of like the 2012 primary for U.S. Senate when Tommy Thompson was running against a bunch of Republicans, Mark Newman, Eric Hovde, Jeff Fitzgerald. They had a very divisive primary there. Tommy was the presumed front runner, but he got nowhere near that 60% threshold at convention. And it was, he emerged from the primary very battered, didn't have any money when he went to take on Tammy Baldwin. Tammy Baldwin easily won in the general election, and she is our senator. So that is the way things can go. We don't know that that's the way that this primary will go because, you know, she seems to have more support from the base of the Republican Party's base, which is who comes to these things, than Tommy did at this point in the election cycle. But I think you could say that there is an opening for someone else. I think the fact that someone like Tim Michaels gets into this race and starts spending on it so heavily is a sign that, you know, people like him think it's potentially winnable by somebody other than Clayfish.
the candidates made their cases to the party faithful there. How are they trying to distinguish themselves from one another? Are there particular issues that stand out or backgrounds or what?
They're very similar on the issues, you know, real similar. And so they're trying to kind of tell a story. For Clayfish, she talks about, I mean, she attaches herself to the Walker years. She was Scott Walker's lieutenant governor. She talks about taking on unions. Actually, at her convention speech, Walker spoke on her behalf, spoke longer than Clayfish did. It could have been, it seemed like she had kind of a hoarse throat there during the convention. That could have been a factor, but she's very much embracing the fact that she was part of the Scott Walker administration. So anything that he did, she is attaching to her record. With Michaels and Nicholson, you see this claim for the outsider label. You know, they're both saying, I'm not really part of politics. I'm an outsider. You could attach stuff that one is saying to the other's campaign almost interchangeably on a lot of this, in a lot of their speeches. And they have both, of course, run for U.S. Senate before and lost. So it's not like they're a stranger to politics. And I think when you look at the candidate that is a little different than the others, it would be Tim Ramthan, the state representative from Campbellsport. And he has made a name for himself as the candidate calling for decertification of Wisconsin's 2020 election, which election law experts and the legislature's own nonpartisan attorneys have said is impossible.
Talking to WPR's own Sean Johnson about this last weekend's Republican state convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It is May. The primary vote is in August. Are you paying close attention yet? Do you have thoughts on a candidate you want to see run against Tony Evers in November for governor? How about Senator Ron Johnson's re-election campaign for the U.S. Senate? I think he's pretty much a shoo-in. We'll talk about him in a bit. What do you want to hear Republicans saying, talking about this midterm election season in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, you just mentioned that effort by one candidate for governor, Tim Ramthan, to overturn the 2020 electoral outcome from Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss addressed that and got a response from the crowd when he affirmed that lawmakers can't do that. Here's a listen.
Now, there is one thing that I believe unites this entire Republican Party, and that's knowing that issues happened in 2020 that have to be fixed going forward to reinstill the confidence that people have in our elections. But I am going to say something that I'm sorry many of you might not want to hear, but we have no ability to decertify the election and go back and nullify it. We do not.
An interesting moment there, Sean.
Yeah, I don't know how well it came across air, but because you're hearing that from Voss's microphone there, but I can tell you, being in the room, those were very loud boos there of the speaker. And, you know, the person moderating that forum, the chairman of the state Republican Party, Paul Farrow, had to kind of interrupt and calm people down, say, hey, we don't do that. We don't boo the speakers here, or the speaker. And so it was remarkable to see. You know that Voss has issues with some members of the Republican base who want to see Republicans embrace ideas like decertification. And it's still striking to hear that. The thing that got me is Robin Voss knows very well that him saying that is going to provoke a reaction in the crowd. He chose to say it. He was not asked about decertification specifically. He was talking more generally about election stuff, and he made a point of stopping to say, hey, by the way, we can't do this thing. So obviously Robin Voss is not afraid of talking about that, regardless of the forum. He is not the most popular person at a Republican state convention these days, but he still seems to have a stronghold on the speaker's office in the Wisconsin Assembly.
another thing that happens at a convention like this, Sean, is that members of the party vote on platform items. They kind of often it'll happen and, you know, nobody reads them, I guess. I'm not sure. But two of the things they voted on and voted down were, should we eject Robin Voss as the assembly speaker, and should we overturn, should we decertify the election? What happened there?
Yeah, so the Voss one got about, I think, 37% of the vote, I want to say. So it failed, 36% of the vote. But 40% of the delegates there said, yeah, we should revoke Wisconsin's, you know, electors from the 2020 presidential election. Again, you know, that's not possible. But this is where this crowd was at. I think it's kind of interesting that you had similar numbers of people were embracing ideas like revoking Wisconsin's electors, and the, you know, saying we should not endorse any of the candidates in these race. I mean, there was a definite strong activist push there at the Republican convention where they're part of the party, they're participating in a party activity here, but they're very critical of the party and of party leaders. And you know, Voss being I guess booted as assembly speaker is something that was also brought up as a resolution at the state party convention last year and failed last year. The decertifying election, the election thing, I believe was new.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about this weekend's state GOP convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you want to be the governor of Wisconsin come 2023 after this November elections? If you're a Republican, how do you feel about the strength of the party in the state coming off of the convention? If you're a Democrat, how worried are you about beating a Republican candidate in the races for governor and U.S. Senate? If you are none of the above, what do you think? Where are you coming from? What do you want to hear Republicans talking about? Do you want focus on the 2020 presidential election or on looking ahead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. He covered the Republican Party of Wisconsin's annual convention this weekend, and you could join in still at 800-642-1234. Do you think the party should have endorsed a candidate in the primary for governor? Were you glad they didn't? Call in now at 800-642-1234. What issues are important to you in the races for governor and U.S. Senate, the big ones here in Wisconsin this year? Is it the 2020 elections? Is it the economy? Is it crime? You name it. What do you want to hear candidates talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or are you holding off on paying attention till the actual primary election month, which is August? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sean, not a lot of calls on issues like the upcoming elections yet. I mean, we in the media and those in political circles, they're paying close attention to this right now. Marquette Law School polls for the primaries for Democrats in the U.S. Senate, Republicans for governor. Again, don't know what's leading in both of those. Maybe the state isn't paying super close attention, even though we are.
I am shocked that people would want to enjoy their May rather than jump headfirst into another election cycle. I mean, what could be more enjoyable than thinking about elections all the time, right? It's a little bit early for the general public. It's definitely not early if you're a candidate, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are in the thick of the campaigns right now. They've built up these campaign staffs. They are spending a lot of money on broadcast TV right now, running ads, particularly with the entrance of Tim Michaels into the governor's race and, you know, inflating those dollar figures. So the campaign season is in full swing, you know, whether or not the general public has recognized it yet.
Well, let's turn to the Senate race now. The Republicans, I think, know solidly who their candidate is going to be. Incumbent Senator Ron Johnson seeking a third term, saying he wanted a unifying message for the party. Here's a listen.
So there's no doubt about it that we need to defeat the radical left ideology, the radical left governance, the radical left policies. But we need to welcome people from all parties. Our coalition is a very inclusive coalition. We want to include everybody, regardless of race or color or creed or gender or sexual preference. Anybody who loves this country needs to be part of our coalition to save this country, because that's what's on the ballot in November.
And that's similar to his messaging in 2016. He called it the Flight 93 election, where comparing it to the terrorist attacks, Republicans needed to take control of the airplane of America, basically, Sean. Did his message play well with Republicans there?
Yeah, I would say his message, if you break it down, he sort of begins with this call for unity. And then, the bulk of his speech was among the most aggressive, we'll say, in terms of the way that I talked about Democrats. It did not speak in unifying terms. Mm-hmm. Very critical of the Democratic Party, very critical of the media, called the media his opponent in his speech in no uncertain terms. So while he's saying that there needs to be an agenda that appeals to everybody, he is not making any kind of an appeal to, Democrats in this speech by any means. He's at a Republican convention. He's at a Republican state convention. I don't think it's surprising that he wouldn't be trying to appeal across the aisle in this place.
Sure.
But he's certainly not making, he's not demonstrating that call for unity in this speech, we'll say. There's not a lot of examples for that. You did hear some calls throughout the convention, though, from Republicans, kind of speaking in more general terms about appealing to voters who are Republicans but just don't know it yet. And so they're talking about people who maybe had Democratic parents, and so that they've voted Democratic but don't necessarily share those ideals, or they're looking for working class Democratic voters who feel like maybe the party has left them. So you do hear those general themes from other Republicans at this thing. But Johnson he's throwing punches out there. He's pretty combative.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Stevens Point. Tom, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tom?
All right. So I have just been recently reading historical documents from the Army orientation talks, number 64, and it's titled Fascism. And in there, it says something about how the fascist will promise all things to all people. They'll promise the rich will get richer, the poor will get richer, et cetera. And obviously, they can't deliver all those things. But when you had played that clip of Ron Johnson talking about how the Republican Party is inclusive, I can't see how they make that claim with any honesty. It sounds a lot like what the Army was talking about in 1945 about fascism.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Sean, Senator Johnson, divisive, brings a lot of attention, I think, from Democrats here in Wisconsin and outside the state. Tough approval ratings right now. Can you talk about Tom's response to Senator Johnson's appeal there?
So I want to be clear, I am not labeling Senator
Sure.
Johnson anything here, but I would say that Senator Johnson is kind of a unique person to deliver the message that he did, because if you look at his numbers in Marquette polling, which we have, I think more than a decade of polling now on Senator Johnson from Marquette, it's really striking that Senator Johnson is, by the numbers, a divisive person. His negatives have gone up. He is beloved by the Republican Party. And the base loves Ron Johnson. He is a very popular person at these conventions, as opposed to Speaker Voss. But he, Ron Johnson has gotten the attention of Wisconsin voters, and for some of them, it's not in a good way. In previous election cycles, it was sort of noteworthy that the election comes up and Ron Johnson has been senator in Wisconsin for years, and a lot of people didn't know who he was. That is not a thing anymore. People know who Ron Johnson is. They have opinions of him that are strongly held. So that's why it was. When Johnson talks about unity, he's just he's not by the numbers the person to deliver that message.
Tom, thanks for that call. Tim joins us now in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi, I was kind of curious why Wisconsin doesn't have many independent candidates, and because I think independent's kind of more of the way to go because the right's gotten too right and the left's gotten too left. So,
you know. Tim, thanks for the call. Sean, there are, like it or not, there are pretty decent-sized hurdles for third parties, independents, whatever, to play the game, right?
Yeah, if you wanted to run for office as a third-party candidate, I think you'd have to have some serious name recognition going in order to make it happen. I mean, I know there have been many instances in American history where a new party has emerged, right? And so I don't want to say that, like, it could never happen, but it's just hard to look at today's political situation and the largesse and the strength of the two parties and imagine somebody emerging as an independent candidate given that playing field.
Thanks for the call, Tim. In just our last minute or so, Sean, what are you watching for next in this midterm election season?
I mean, I think we are kind of generally watching for, you know, how the year evolves. We know that, like, historically, when you have one party in control of the White House and Congress, it's not a great year for them in the midterm elections. And so this would be, you know, just historically a good year for Republicans. But then you look at our incumbent candidates in Wisconsin and people's views of them, is there a chance that that could buck the trend? You know, have Johnson's negatives gotten too high? And in the case of Evers, you would think he'd be in a pretty bad place, right? But his polling is still pretty decent. You know, one thing that Senator Devin Lemieux said during a legislative roundtable was that he's a little worried that voters are going to look at Evers and, you know, Evers is like a nice and decent guy. That's his concern in this election year. That seems to be something that Evers has going for him that continues to work for him, is that he's kind of boring, kind of nice. And that may be what voters want in the year 2022. So we'll see how he holds up in this election year.
We'll leave it there. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR Sean Johnson looking at the Wisconsin Republican Party convention this weekend in Middleton. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at efforts to provide better mental health treatment to kids and adults. That's tomorrow morning at 8. I've mentioned on the show before that I'm using one of those language apps to study Spanish and some other languages. And now I say study and not learn. I know from experience I'm not a real quick learner when it comes to foreign languages, but I try. But here's the thing I like about Spanish. The same letter makes the same sound pretty much every time. And the same group of letters, they make the same sound pretty much every time. I feel bad for people who are doing what I'm doing to try to learn English, though. The letter C can be K or S. Unless you got an H after it, then all bets are off. And then clusters of letters. Take O-U-G-H. That can give you rough or through or dough or drought or cough. So that's uff, oo, oh, ow, or off with the same set of four letters. But why? We're going to find out tomorrow with the author of a new book on the weird quirks of the English language, how they got to be that way. You could share your favorite examples. Email right now, ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It'll be tough. We'll get through it. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new cookbook uses ingredients you'd find in a typical food pantry. We'll find out how it's helping people who are dealing with food insecurity here in Wisconsin. Now, when we think of wildfires, we might think of the western part of the U.S., but we've experienced some substantial fires here in Wisconsin in the distant past and in more recent years. Spring is the time wildfires are most likely to happen in the state when snow has melted, humidity is low, and people burn yard waste. Earlier this month, the state DNR listed 52 counties as very high risk for wildfires. That's gone down a lot since then. Our next guest has advice on preventing wildfires in the spring and throughout the year. Catherine Cooley is a wildfire prevention specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Catherine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. Always great to be here.
Can you talk a little more about why spring is seen sometimes as peak wildfire season in the state?
You know, that's such a great question to start with, because I think there are a lot of misconceptions out there. Spring is certainly wildfire season in Wisconsin. You know, shortly after that snow cover disappears and right before vegetation fully greens out, that is really the peak of our fire season. You know, a lot of times we see the Western fire situation, you know, really heating up over the summer. But ours is before that summertime occurs. So certainly we're on the downslope of our peak. But certainly, you know, there are opportunities for more fires to occur.
Yeah, earlier this month, wow, 52 counties at very high risk. Happily, that's come down since then. Does that time of year get to be a nail biter for you?
Absolutely. It's been a busy couple weeks here. And certainly this year was more of a traditional fire season in the sense where, you know, kind of started in the southern part of the state and moved north as that snow cover disappeared. But we've been steady, you know, since mid-March. And, you know, usually fire season, you know, the bulk of that fire activity wraps up by Labor Day. So we're on track for a very average fire year.
What are some of the most common causes of a wildfire here in the state?
So believe it or not, 98% of our fires are caused by people. And, you know, the good news is 98% of them can be prevented. You know, the biggest thing we see is folks getting out, you know, that living with that snow and wanting to get out and clean up around your yard. And then folks choosing to burn that stuff. So, you know, leaves, brush, pine needles, and then deciding to light that stuff up and have a fire. And a lot of times, you know, people don't know the rules, they don't know the fire danger, or they walk away from their fire. And a lot of times that's what causes the damage.
If people are going to burn that yard waste like that, what are the rules? What do they need to know before they do it?
So I kind of like to think of it in terms of like a three-step process. So think of, you know, before you decide to burn, you know, during your burn and then after your burn. So before you decide you want to burn your pile, you know, consider alternatives. You know, there are other options out there. You don't have to burn that pile. Know what the burning permits are. Follow the rules on that permit. You know, a lot of times people will just get the permit and think, oh, I'm okay. In reality, there's a lot of great tips on there. There's certain times we encourage people to burn, typically in the evening when the conditions are a little bit safer. And then, you know, make sure that what you're burning is legal, and then keep an eye on that weather, and then make sure that the area around your fire is free from any flammable material. And then while you're burning, make sure you have a water source, you have some tools. You know, you're not making your fire too big. Make it manageable, something that you can, you know, control under your supervision. Clear that area around that fire break, make sure nothing's creeping out. Never leave that fire unattended. You know, like I said, a lot of times people will light it, they'll be burning for a couple hours, and then they'll just walk away. And a lot of times those fires will kick up some embers in there and then start a fire as well. And then after you burn, you know, you got to make sure it's out. Those little embers can hide in there for days, even weeks, believe it or not. So making sure that those coals are completely cold, lots of water, stir, and then go back and check it again later.
It's a camping season in Wisconsin. I'm pretty sure most campers in Wisconsin know the rules for their campfires. But for maybe first timers, can you let them know what to make sure they're doing?
Absolutely. And you know what? It's kind of the same rule of thumb. So think of it in terms of that three-step process, before, during, and after. I mean, we've got the Memorial Day weekend this weekend. We're going to have, you know, cooler nights still. So a lot of campfires on the horizon. And, you know, just, you know, if you can, try to kind of have it in the evening, you know, make sure you're around it, keeping it attended, like I said, you know, and then also just, you know, making sure that that fires are, you know, under your control the entire time. So a lot of times people will maybe have a couple cocktails and then go for a walk or go do something else. You know, a lot of times we see things happen under those circumstances, unfortunately.
Wisconsin has a big fire history, the Peshtigo fire that happened the same night as the Great Chicago fire. It was huge and destructive. But we don't have to go back that far. There was that big German Road fire in Douglas and Bayfield counties in 2013. That's the kind of thing we're worried about here, right?
Absolutely. You know, I think while wildfire events are far fewer in numbers in terms of the window of opportunity for these large scale events, Wisconsin is not safe from a catastrophic fire. You know, these things can happen under the right conditions. You know, in 2013, when the German Road fire did happen, that burned 8,000 acres, you know, that was one of our lower fire years in terms of fire occurrence. You know, it sprinkled that morning. You know, folks thought, oh, things are, you know, not so bad. Unfortunately, you know, a spark in the wrong place at the right time can really result in those events.
What kind of resources are there for people to find out the current fire risk in their local area?
So the DNR does a great job of monitoring the weather conditions, the fuel moistures. You can go to the DNR homepage and search fire, dnr.wi.gov, and we monitor that fire danger every day. We look at those reports in the morning right away and have that fire danger updated every day at 11 a.m. That fire danger can change every day, and we can go from low to high very quickly or high to low very quickly, especially this time of year. So it's really important to not become complacent and think you know what the fire danger was yesterday, because it could be a different story today.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Catherine Cooley, wildfire prevention specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She talked to us about wildfire prevention here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about pregnancy during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Tens of thousands of people in the U.S. turn to fertility clinics every year to help them grow their families. For many of those hopeful parents, the process can be an emotional roller coaster, not to mention expensive. Alexandra Meyer of Milwaukee is one mother who tried in vitro fertilization and other methods when she was trying to get pregnant. And then the pandemic hit. Meyer shares her experience as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
I had fertility treatments lined up to start at the end of March 2020. Then COVID hit and the stay-at-home order came down. When I called the clinic a few days later, the nurse said, "I'm really sorry. We aren't doing any procedures. We're not seeing any patients. Fertility treatment has been deemed non-essential." So then, because this is something that for me was essential in order to have my child, having treatments put on pause and not knowing when the end date of that pause would be was super scary. And then I call in April. "Sorry, we can't do it this month." May. "We're really sorry. We can't do it this month either." In June, finally they say, "We can get you in." The first procedure we did was an IUI. And then 2 weeks later, I got another negative pregnancy test, like I'd seen so many times before. After three unsuccessful rounds of IUI, we decided to transition to IVF. My doctor told me, "If you get COVID during any point of your treatment plan, we have to stop. You're out all of that money. You have to pay for it again to do it again, and you have lost that chance." COVID cases in Wisconsin were surging, and I didn't know if a simple interaction would get me sick or not. We had been dealing with infertility for 6 years at that point, and I couldn't lose this chance because I was finally feeling hopeful. The supply chain issues we had throughout the pandemic didn't just affect toilet paper. It also affected IVF meds. And when I went to the pharmacy to pick up these extremely expensive medications, they told me, "We don't know if we have them all in stock. And if I don't have these medications, then we might have to cancel the cycle." Luckily, they had it. They were able to do an egg retrieval after a lot of at-home injections. The egg retrieval gave us three viable embryos. After my embryo transfer, I tested early at home. It was so early in the morning. I looked at it and like, here it is again, another negative. So I leave it on the counter. I'm crying. I go back to bed. I'm done. This was a positive pregnancy test, and I'd gotten so used to negative tests that I just thought it would be negative, and I was too tired to look at it closely. I tested every day leading up to our blood draw, and the line kept getting darker. Like, it's happening. It's really happening this time. I just really hope that for those that do IVF during the pandemic, that they get their miracle babies too.
Alexandra Meyer of Milwaukee welcomed a baby girl in July 2021. They enjoy snuggling and reading books together. Meyer's story comes to us from the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the resiliency, humor, and heartbreak of pregnancy and birth during the COVID-19 pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new cookbook aims to help low-income families in Wisconsin make ends meet. We'll hear from a creator with some advice on cooking on a budget. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, a woman from Grafton developed a cookbook that uses ingredients you'd typically find at a food pantry. She's hoping the cookbook will help make cooking more accessible for food pantry clients. The book was created for Family Sharing, a nonprofit food pantry serving Ozaukee County. Connie Roller is the author of the cookbook. Connie, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And Julie Hoover is executive director of Family Sharing. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Now, Connie, I understand you'd already written a couple cookbooks for family and friends. Where did the inspiration for this food pantry cookbook come from?
Well, it's a two-part thing. Number one, I had my teenage daughter had a friend whose mother just cooked opening cans, and he came here to eat all the time. And when I produced one of my family cookbooks, gave him a copy, he went to the grocery store carrying that copy every single time he went. And he learned to cook from that, and he definitely has a better life. The other was just, you know, seeing the products that people donated to Family Sharing. And I would look around at all of those things, and my mind just jumped to, wow, what could I do with all this? And the idea just kind of snowballed from there.
And Julie, can you talk about the work you do at the food pantry and why this kind of cookbook could be helpful with education on nutrition and cooking?
Absolutely. So we serve people across Ozaukee County, and the organization has been around since the 70s. We have a mobile pantry that goes out in the community and a number of other programs to serve. And I remember when I first started here, I met a gentleman who grew up, his mother refused to make pancakes. They never had pancakes in the house. And it turns out that she grew up going to a food pantry, and that was the thing that they had all the time. It was their only option. And that was such an aha to me, because growing up in my house, pancakes were a treat. And I thought, there's so many things that we give out to people every single time they come to the food pantry that we really have to think about providing something that's new and different. Nobody wants to eat the exact same thing over and over again. So it's something that had been on my mind for years. And when Connie approached me wanting to do a cookbook, I thought, oh, this is such a great opportunity to take the things that we give away to our regular clients, but put a spin on them to keep them interesting, to make sure that their kids eat them and they get utilized. So we were thrilled that Connie had the skills and the heart to want to do this.
Connie, can you talk about how you tried to, you know, mix things up and have variety in the foods that people might see regularly at their pantry?
Well, I started out with, Julie provided me a list of the common food pantry ingredients that people donated. And then I reached out to a lot of friends and family who are also foodies like me, and said, okay, this is a list we have. Let's come up with some recipes that could utilize these ingredients and elevate them. You know, you cannot just keep opening a can of soup. You can't just keep making a boxed scalloped potatoes. You have to be able to do more and more. And I guess that's how it started.
Julie, can you talk about food insecurity in Ozaukee County? I know I've talked to your counterparts in some of your neighboring counties who say, you know, even our local community might not be aware of the need for this.
Absolutely. There's definitely a need. We have a lot of people who live above the poverty line. We don't have as much homelessness as maybe some other counties have, but a lot of people who don't make enough to live in this county. As many people know, Ozaukee County is one of the wealthier counties, but that means that everything is more expensive here. Rent, getting your car fixed, childcare are all more expensive. So for people to keep up, even before the inflation that we've started to see, it's a struggle for a lot of people. And sometimes they have to make choices between buying food and buying medication or childcare and food. So we're here to help provide the food so that their precious resources can go to the other essential items in their budget.
Connie, can you talk about how you dealt with substitutions? Maybe, frozen corn might be available one week, canned corn another. How do you, in your recipes, let people know, hey, you could substitute this stuff?
In the foreword of my cookbook, I actually address that issue that you may not always have the exact ingredients that are available to you. For instance, canned beans in a soup or a casserole. If you don't have kidney beans, use black beans. If you don't have, if you don't have frozen peas, use canned peas or fresh peas or whatever. Food pantries have come a long way lately in having a lot more fresh ingredients as opposed to just canned. So there's a lot more options out there. But, substituting or improvising, I encourage it because that's how I cook. I don't follow recipes. I just cook with what I have and God bless it. It turns out.
I got to ask Connie, because that's kind of how I tend to cook. And I've definitely had my Polish grandma just cooked, you put in the right amount of stuff. There's no writing down. Was it a challenge for you to take those recipes, those ideas in your head and like put them in a form that the rest of us can reproduce?
No, actually, no? That's not a challenge for me. That's very, very easy for me to do. I have a background in writing, editing. I've done 2 family cookbooks already, so that's easy for me.
And excellent.
That's part of, why I wanted to do this for family sharing is because I could do this easily. I could go there and I could volunteer and I could sort donations, or I could use the talents that I have to make something a little bit better. Right now, the only thing I need to do to make this a little bit better is to raise the funds to actually get these cookbooks printed and handed out.
And Julie, what are your hopes for getting the cookbooks more available to more people?
Well, first, I have to say to Connie, that is quite the skill. That is not a skill I have,
right.
So I'm in awe of that. It enables us to do what we do best, that we can get it in the hands of our clients and have the conversation with them of what it is and how it came to fruition and how they can utilize it. So we're excited to get it in their hands and get them excited about cooking. They're busy with families, with a job, 2 jobs, daycare, everything else that goes with it. So the fact that these are delicious and easy, we're excited to give them to people and maybe even make some samples of certain recipes so that people can try it and then entice them to expand their cooking horizons. I think we all get in ruts sometimes. So,
and Connie, as you just said, you were inspired to use your talents to help people. If there's other people out there with talents, whether it's cooking or something else, can you leave us with a little encouragement for them to use those talents to help people out?
I guess I have to say, whatever your talents are. If you have a talent for photography, go to an animal shelter and take beautiful photos of pets that need homes. If you have a talent for cooking, maybe offer cooking lessons to somebody. If you have a talent for making money, donate to me being able to print this cookbook and get it out to as many people as possible.
Fantastic. Connie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
That was Connie.
We appreciate it.
It's Connie Roller, author of the cookbook From Pantry to Table, and Julie Hoover, executive director of Family Sharing, with us today to talk about Connie's new cookbook, which she wrote specifically for ingredients that people find typically at a food pantry. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. crossed the 1 million mark for COVID deaths, with millions more affected by those losses. A Wisconsin philosopher joins the show to tell us why it can be hard to wrap our minds around those numbers. Plus, an author tells us why some of the weird things of the English language, how they ended up that way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.